Some of you are going to find this a bit incredulous, but here's something that federal, state, and local governments all tell us to do that we should actually listen to. Eat more fruits and vegetables. You've heard about the health benefits of increasing plant-based nutrients into your diet, but how can you easily consume all the fruits and veggies needed? Well, it's easy. By adding grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity into your meals. Grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity is a power blend that has 31 fruits and vegetables in every scoop. Organic vegetables, super greens, super fruits, and super sprouts. It is fortified with essential vitamins plus an immunity boost. And right now, you can get a free 2-week supply of grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity by just paying $8.95 for the shipping and handling. And not only that, you'll also get a free frother to quickly whip up your healthy and nutritious grown American drink. Go to grownamericansuperfood.com/John and order today.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
Welcome. How you doing? It's Progress After Dark. Thank you, Dino Badala, for the excellent lead-in that I can never hope to measure up to. I'm Fugelsang, aided and abetted by the most dangerous production squad in radio, Chris Hauselt, running this beast out of South Carolina, the great Thea Harper producing our show out of Brooklyn. For the next 3 hours, we're going to be coming at you with facts, empathy, music, and something resembling, but not quite achieving, wit. From Los Angeles, yes, we are in three different states bringing this show to you together, and I hope you had a great Thursday. We're almost done with the week. I'm going to be flying later tonight up upstate. They don't say upstate in California, but I'm from New York. We're flying upstate to perform at the Napa Valley Performing Arts Center tomorrow night. I will still be doing the show. I'll just be racing as soon as we wrap to get over to the Performing Arts Center. You can go to performingartsnapavalley.org. I'm playing with Tony Jackson and Sean Lynch, who are very funny guys. That's the Napa Valley Comedy Festival tomorrow night at the Napa Valley Performing Arts Center. Now that that's done, I hope you had a great Thursday. It's been a bit crazy today. We have some great guests tonight. Dave Zirin, who's the best writer in America on sports and the intersection of sports and politics. I try to get Dave on once or twice a year. He's just that brilliant. He's going to be joining us this evening talking about how gambling is taking over sports. And we'll have Julie Franchella and Simon Moya-Smith for our Indigenous Voices segment in hour two. So it's going to be a really good one. Tomorrow night, Frank Conop is back and Amanda Marcotte of Salon. I'm reading the story right now. I'm trying to wrap my head around this. Maybe you can come over here and help me understand. The Republican National Committee, it turns out they're really mad at NBC because NBC decided to drop former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel as a contributor. You see, they fired her viciously after her years of loyalty to Donald Trump. He personally had her fired and replaced her with his grifter daughter-in-law. And then NBC almost hired her, and now they're not going to hire her. And the RNC are really mad that NBC didn't go through with hiring the person they fired. So now they're saying that they might restrict NBC's access to this summer's convention to protest them not hiring the woman they brutally fired. Only they get to treat Ronna McDaniel like absolute garbage. You don't. You know, there's a famous story that, you know, the Beatles, that like George and John, if they were hanging out in the 70s and beyond in a recording studio, and if anybody who was playing with them, recording with them after the breakup, if anyone, you know, in their solo careers in the studio ever talked any crap about Paul, both George and John would shut them down. They would always say, no, Paul's our family. We get to talk shit about Paul. You don't get to talk shit about Paul. This is sort of the RNC saying, you don't get to be shitty to Ronna. Only we get to be shitty. Now, they didn't elaborate on what a hard look means, but imagine a major showdown with the press at the biggest political event of the year when they're going to be nominating a man we can pretty safely assume will have been convicted of a crime by then. And this particular man cares a lot about media coverage. Please, please, RNC, make this a major story. Please block NBC from covering the convention so Donald Trump can come out there and talk about liberal censorship. Punish NBC for not hiring the woman you just fired. Thank you. Joe Biden this evening is having a $25 million fundraiser for over 5,000 supporters at Radio City Music Hall, right across the street from SiriusXM Studios. So I'm glad we're not in studio tonight, because it's a nightmare for driving and parking and getting around when one president is in town. But right now, Obama and Bill Clinton are there with President Biden across the street. And Queen Latifah and Lizzo are there as well. If you're in Midtown Manhattan, just stay where you are. Just make camp. You're not going anywhere tonight. You're not getting out of town. I mean, thanks for the traffic. But they reveal they've already raised an incredible $25 million. This sets a record for the biggest cash haul ever for a political event. So Joe Biden's war chest was already, what, $155 million? I only went to public school, but I think 25, carry the 7, that's $180 million. Donald Trump has a little over 50 million combined and spread around. And of course, he's using all that to pay for his lawyers for his crimes and his bribes and his fraud and his rape and his thefts and his obstructions and his conspiracy. I could go on. The RNC has about $11 million on hand for 2024. $11 million on hand. This is the RNC for all the candidates in 50 states. Around $11 million. Here's a perspective. At this point in 2020, they had $77 million. Now it's $11 million. So that's why Donald Trump is selling Bibles. He's selling $60 Bibles when he's not selling cologne or softcore gay porn NFT trading cards or hideous-looking gold puffy sneakers. I mean, he has just such an incredible relationship with the profoundly fake Christians of America. And this is the grand compromise. I mean, they call them evangelicals. There's a lot of things we can call them. They are hardcore right-wing fundamentalists. Some would call them Christo-fascists. Some would call them the American Taliban. I call them grab them by the pussy evangelicals. I call them Christians in name only, for chinos. You know the chinos. Some of them are brown. Some are white. Most are some shade of beige. Many are wrinkled. Most are irregular. They're all a little too straight. This is Christianity in America today, which means right-wing Christianity will forego anything the guy their religion's named after taught to get a guy like Trump elected president. And he uses Christian imagery to speak to these people who haven't actually read the Bible but respond well to pictures. I mean, you know, the obviously putting these three right-wing crackpots on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade made Christians happy, even though the Bible, not against abortion. And this is how bankrupt Christianity in our country has been, that this demagogue can just completely co-opt and mount and hump your faith and now sell the Holy Scriptures for profit. Do these idiots understand, like, a billionaire has a bunch of Bibles and he's selling them for $60 a piece? Wouldn't a Christian billionaire, I don't know, hear me out on this, hand out, give it away for... And it's fitting that he's selling these God Bless the USA Bibles with Lee Greenwood, because again, like Trump, Lee Greenwood's a one-hit wonder. And MAGA, when it comes to the Bible, they only know one or two of the greatest hits. They actually don't know most of what's in the album. By the way, God is now selling hideous puppy sneakers to raise money as well. It's all a grift. I mean, and again, maybe some MAGAs will be dumb enough to do this and their kids will get the Bible and actually read the Jesus parts. But on this campaign trail, Trump, you're going to see it. They're going to go more, not Jesus-like, just more messianic imagery. They're going to keep on saying he's the chosen one. Do you know that at his rallies, they play this video before, and there's some narrator imitating Paul Harvey, and he says on June 14th, 1946, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God gave us Trump. Let's put aside the fact that that's blasphemy and that Donald Trump is not a caretaker of paradise whatsoever. He's really a big fan of pollution. And let's put aside the fact that Trump literally stole all of this from Ron DeSantis' campaign announcement ad he did last year. This is creepy shit. They're now actually blaspheming and saying that God gave us... I mean, you understand, if you've actually read the Bible, this is troublesome. Donald Trump, on the first day of his New York civil trial, he shared this AI picture of him sitting next to Jesus. Wasn't a very good AI picture. It looked more like Trump sitting next to Dwayne Allman, but you understand. And then this week he posted this message he said he got from a follower. It's ironic that Christ walked through his greatest persecution the very week they are trying to steal your property from you. Yeah. Happy Easter week, everyone. Trump doesn't go to church. Trump does not know the Bible. Trump has never in his life flirted with any kind of Christianity. This is how bankrupt it is right now. This is how dead American Christianity on the right side is. And this is fundamentalism. You know, fundamentalists don't think they're better than you. They think God thinks they're better than you. And they don't actually care what's in their holy book. I mean, think about it. If any of these Republicans really were Christian, they'd have to do the things that Jesus commands. Welcome the stranger. They don't want to do that. They want to persecute the stranger. Jesus commands individuals and nations to care for the poor and care for the sick. They don't want to do that. That's socialism. They want private insurance to make all that money. Jesus says, pay your taxes, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Oh, no, 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 boo-boo. They're literally led by a guy who brags that he doesn't pay his taxes and has been convicted of not paying his taxes. I mean, across the board, Jesus was against the death penalty. Trump killed more federal prisoners in his term of office than every other president in the last 100 years combined. There is no Jesus-based evidence, I mean, Jesus-based justification for Trump support. I mean, where do they get it? What is the deal with these people? Well, the deal is they're fundamentalists. They're not Christians. They're the far right wing of the Christian religion. And here's the thing. The far right wing of every religion is its own religion. Fundamentalist Christians, fundamentalist Muslims, fundamentalist Jews, they have more in common with each other than they do with liberal or moderate Christians, Muslims, and Jews across the board. I mean, this is what Christian nationalism is. And again, Christian nationalism is not the same as fundamentalists. Fundamentalists are the ones who believe that they speak for God. And if you're against them, then you're against God. Now, they really don't like extreme conservative religious Muslims. They're fine with extreme conservative religious Christians, but the extreme conservative religious Muslims, they don't like that. They don't like the Muslim Brotherhood. We have the Christian Brotherhood, except they're not very Christian, and they don't like brothers. But, you know, I mean, our atheist friends like to say that religion's responsible for all the world's hate and violence and war and oppression, and they're actually wrong. It's the extreme conservative people of every religion. Religion's not inherently evil, and the overwhelming majority of progressive, moderate, and even some conservative Christians, Jews, and Muslims get along just fine right now. It's the hardcore true believers, addicted to believing they're always on God's side. They're the ones making planet Earth violent and bloody and unjust and unequal and polluted and complicated for the rest of us. The fires of most of our conflicts today are fanned most ferociously by the hardcore conservatives of every religion. Look what happens when you put conservative religious in power. You get Iran. You get George W. Bush saying God told him to invade Iraq. You get Netanyahu, this criminal thug in Israel. You get Hamas, these Nazi gangsters in Palestine. They're all fundamentalists, extreme authoritarian religious theocratic rule. And as it gets less popular, the fundamentalists get more radical. You know, our Christian Taliban, they know they're losing the culture war. So they're going to try to keep their power by gerrymandering voting districts, blocking immigration reform, and creating non-existent voter fraud scares to justify further gutting the Voting Rights Act. Yeah, they're the same. I'm comparing our conservative Christians to their hardcore conservative Muslims because the fundamentalists of all the religions are all doing their best to create hell right here on Earth. Now, maybe you live with an extreme conservative religious or work for one or voted for one, but here's the checklist to tell if you're dealing with one. Number one, the more conservative your religion, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, the more you believe God hates gay people. I mean, think about it. It's not the liberal Muslims and Jews and Greeks, the conservative, okay? And that's obviously why he created so many of them across the world throughout all of recorded human history and every culture that's ever kept records, because God can't stand them. He can't stand them, but he can't stop creating them. And he can't seem to smite them, so he needs you to clean up his mess. The gay thing, all fundamentalists. Number two, the woman thing. Liberal and moderate religious sects honor women, extol women. But the ultra-Orthodox of most faiths never run out of reasons why women, they're fine. They're not as good as men. And Christianity's no exception. If you follow the rules of the Bible word for word, then not Jesus, but other parts of the Bible, women are cursed. They can't speak in temple. Paul is very specific about that. Women are unclean when they have a child. And if it's a female child, they're unclean for twice as long. The religion still believes, if you believe Adam and Eve is literal fact, you have to believe that women have monthly menstruation and painful childbirth because Eve talked to a snake. And we know the Vatican policy on women priests, no knob, no job. The woman thing. The more right-wing your religion is, the more women are second-class citizens. Then, the superiority thing. It's great to love your religion as long as you're being nice to people. That's sort of the point. But the more conservative your faith, the more you look down on other religions as inferior. Think about it. Is it the liberal Christians, Muslims, and Jews who are sneering and hating other religions? Or is it the arch conservatives of all religions? Because if you think your religion is the one true one, then you speak for God. And if you speak for God, you're not going to sit down and negotiate with Satan or some infidel on things like school curriculum or gender or gay marriage. Never mind that you allegedly worship the same God. I mean, people just think you're going to hell because your parents put you in the wrong God fan club. And the fourth trait that all of religious fundamentalists of all faiths share, they think violence is okay if they do it. In the Old Testament, God really likes smiting. He smites people all over the place. That's how he solves problems. That's how we know he's a man. The modern fundamentalist religious people, they know it's okay to overlook whatever their holy book says about killing people because they know they've got to get out of hell free card. Violence is okay if my side does it. Never mind if God or Allah or Jehovah wanted anybody dead. He'd probably just smite them himself. But he's not. And then the fifth trait of being a religious fundamentalist, these sex hangups. Now, again, Trump supporters, they seem to have gotten over some of these. Well, we have Trump. They have the Trump exception. Trump is allowed to be as decadent a lech as possible. But God forbid any of you gays or women enjoy sex out there. Young people enjoying sex. Gay people enjoying sex. It's all evil to fundamentalists. Sex for pleasure? No, it's for procreation. And God obviously hardwired humans to deeply enjoy the mating process because God really hates the mating process he designed. In the Christian faith, Jesus doesn't have any sex hangups. That's all St. Paul, his conservative PR guy. But if God hated sex, he could have found a more boring means of reproduction, people. You know why a puppy humps your leg? He hasn't been taught to be afraid of hell. So that's a quick little checklist. And the best thing is, it proves there aren't many differences in the world religions. There are the hardcore conservative fundamentalists of every faith, and there's the rest of us. And that's probably the greatest thing religious fundamentalists have in common. That, again, they don't think they're better than you. They think God thinks they're better than you. And let me remind you, when you're looking at this, extreme conservative religious people mixing it up with authoritarian governments is literally what killed Jesus. Thought I'd bring that up because tomorrow is Good Friday. So look, I know it's scary. I know it's getting scary out there and the polls are what they are. But if you've checked, Biden's made some pretty good gains against Trump in the last month in six of the seven 2024 swing states, according to the Bloomberg Morning Consult poll that came out today. He did really well after State of the Union. He performed best in the Rust Belt states. And, you know, the polls show the president's got a 1-point lead in Wisconsin, tied with Trump in Pennsylvania and Michigan. And I don't buy any of these polls. You have to always assume that Biden's down 5 points anywhere. I don't buy any of these polls. I don't want to get complacent over it. But they've changed. The polls do skew conservative. Again, these are polls of people who pick up their landlines, polls of people who pick up their cell phones when they don't know who is there. And yes, third parties, they could be a significant factor. But eight new polls have Biden ahead. Emerson College, Biden's 51%. Mainstream Research, 47 to 45, Biden. Ipsos and Reuters, 39 Biden, 38 Trump. Civics poll, 45 Biden, 44 Donald. YouGov, Biden's got a 1-point lead at 45%. Kaiser, Biden's got a 3-point lead. Tip, Biden's got a 1-point lead. Donald Trump has spent more than $100 million on lawyers and other legal costs with his various lawsuits in the last 3 years. As we reported last night, because the New York Times reported it, Donald Trump has spent more than $90,000 a day on average for legal costs for more than 3 years, and none of it was paid with his own money. Guys, it's a grift on the fake Christians. It's a grift on the RNC. Let him bankrupt them and redistribute their wealth, and the irony will continue to be that the liberals and the atheists are the ones doing the Lord's work. We want to know what you guys think. We're at 866-997-4748. 866-997-GRIT. We're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back with the great Dave Zirin. This is Progress.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
And welcome back. Dave Zirin is the nation's sports editor. He's the author of 10 books on the politics of sports, most recently the acclaimed Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. He was named one of Utney Reader's 50 Visionaries Who Are Changing the World. You've seen him on ESPN, MSNBC, Democracy Now. Catch his amazing reporting and great interviews at Edge of Sports on YouTube, as well as through his website, edgeofsports.com. Mr. Zirin, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
It is so great to be here, John. I have no words. And that'll be my position for the rest of the interview.
Okay, that's right. I demand your silence. There's so much to talk to. You know what they always say, Mr. Zirin, that soccer is the only sport that unites everybody in the world. And your latest article on Edge of Sports suggests that the current president, Gianni Infantino, feels otherwise. I'm curious, what do his recent remarks or lack thereof regarding Palestine tell him about him and the organization?
Gianni Infantino, a.k.a. Johnny Boy, or as I like to call him, Johnny Boy Infantino, the enfant terrible of soccer. See, Gianni Infantino jumped on the issue of Ukraine and Russia, you know, immediately moving to sanction Russia, and the hypocrisy in terms of the absence of action by FIFA with regards to Israel and Palestine is really actually shocking a lot of people. I mean, not so much as a statement, not so much as a call for ceasefire. Now, I know some people might be saying it's a soccer organization. Who the heck cares what they have to say about Middle Eastern policy? Well, they have stepped in it time and time again. You know, and it's branding. They want the world to know that soccer is an instrument of peace, that soccer is what unites the world, that soccer is somehow has a power that other sports do not have, and frankly, other cultural entities do not have. But the thing is that now people, activists, citizens, are taking him up on this. Soccer fans in the stands at games, soccer players, masses of people are saying, okay, you're more than this. You always talk about soccer being this force for good and peace in the world. Where are you right now as what I and AOC would describe as a looming genocide settles over the Gaza Strip. I mean, it's the sort of thing where you look at someone like Gianni Infantino and you wonder where the moral compass is and who are the masters to which he serves.
As you note in the piece, let me quote you. The price of FIFA's self-censorship came into focus this week after Israel killed star Palestinian national team member Mohammed Barakat. And for those who haven't heard this story, can you tell us, Dave, who was the man known as the legend of Khan Yunis? What happened to him, and what does this story tell us?
Well, he was killed alongside members of his family in a bombing run in Khan Yunis. And it's one of those things where I don't know whether how to even talk about it, if it's a blessing, if it's a curse, if it's a necessity. But the fact is that he recorded his last moments, his last words for the world to see. And yes, it is so important that he was not deliberately unheard in death and that he was able to say his piece for the world. It also tears your guts out a million different ways to see somebody, you know, almost my age, you know, middle-aged man, children, family, you know, speaking about how it's time for him to say goodbye because he knows the planes are coming for him. And it's so upsetting because what he meant to the people of Khan Yunis and Gaza was something so much greater than just a soccer player. Yeah. Because not a lot of soccer players get out of Gaza, you know, because of checkpoints, because of the absence of facilities, because of the inability to play with the more experienced coaches over in the West Bank because of those same checkpoints. I mean, and this has frankly been something that people have called upon Israel to be sanctioned for years for by FIFA. The fact that Palestine does have an official team, yet has a very difficult time fielding the team because right. of Israel's checkpoints. And so that question has been said, why doesn't FIFA have something to say about that? Has been a longstanding question. And in the past, there have been some mealy-mouthed statements from FIFA, but nothing the likes of which that calls for any semblance of peace or justice. We don't get that from FIFA. We got it around Russia and Ukraine, but we're not getting around Israel and Palestine. And you know, what's so distressing about it is that you have so many forces in our society. From the United Nations, for goodness sakes, like calling for a ceasefire, and yet FIFA is too worried it's going to somehow upset its Western backers, particularly the United States, if it steps into such a situation and somehow offends people. When people are saying, well, wait a minute, you're FIFA, you always talk about how you're this force for good in the world, where are you now? I should have added also about Mohammed Barakat. I'm sorry I got off topic.
That's okay.
He played professionally in Jordan. He played professionally in Saudi Arabia. He scored over 100 goals in the Gaza League. No one had done that. I mean, he was a figure. And the thing is that when you go after sports heroes, you're also going after hope. You're going after the idea that there could be normalcy.
That's right.
The idea that the most challenging thing in your life is going to be your fans' passion over a soccer game or your favorite player. I mean, the things that we frankly take for granted, I mean, is what a military action is intended to destroy so people stop resisting. And that's what I see with this. And frankly, that's what I see with the dozens upon dozens of athletes and officials who've been killed in Gaza since this began.
Well, this is what I learned from your piece, Mr. Zirin, because my American corporate media didn't teach me anything about Barakat and how he was the first Gaza player to score 100 goals, or that he was killed on the first day of fasting. Yes. And I didn't know until I read your piece that actually hundreds of Palestinian players have been killed by these attacks. Now, I know that our media doesn't like to talk about soccer on a good day, Dave, but what is the coverage of this loss of life in the sports world like in the rest of the world? I mean, are Europeans talking about these athletes who've been killed?
Well, it's more of a story in Europe, for sure. And the names are said. We're not getting it not only here generally, but also we're not getting it in our U.S. sports media by any stretch of the imagination. They're too busy trying to sell us gambling ads to talk about what's happening in Israel, Palestine. They're scared to step in it. And the fear factor is so striking to me. I think about this all the time, John, that it has never been more a part of a national wave of popular opinion to say, wait a minute, Palestinians are people too. We need to take their humanity into account. That's never been more of a sentiment in the United States in my lifetime. And yet at the same time, it's never been more dangerous to employment, to prospects, to whatever you want to say, to actually stand up and say those things. I mean, it operates in a way where if you're with 80% of the public on a question, then that gives you more space to speak out. And yet I'm finding that the opposite is the case, that the chilling effect is very real, that people's fear over being singled out, being called anti-Semitic, is a real fear that people have, particularly people who see themselves on the liberal left, who would like to die before being called anti-Semitic. But they want to stand for Palestinian rights at the same time, but then they're paralyzed by fear. I mean, frankly, that's why I talk about it all the time, because I feel like as a Jewish person, I'm insulated from a lot of that critique, you know, unless they want to call me a self-hating Jew. And as Larry David said, I hate myself, but it has nothing to do with being Jewish. You know, it's the good line to throw back at people. Or these days, I've seen this young generation of activists who I've gotten to know in groups like Jewish Voice for Peace or If Not Now. It's like sometimes they wear shirts that say self-loving Jew. And that always fills me with all the warms in my heart. But it's like that's like if people are listening and they're saying, why is this guy being such a loudmouth about this issue? It's because I can be. And a lot of people feel...
I should add, you know, I'm raised Catholic, so we have a whole different layer of that whole thing. David Duke, I was debating David Duke once on Bill Maher, and he said I hate myself. He said that I hated myself because I'm white, and I had to point out that was bullshit. I hate myself because I'm Catholic. I want to talk about gambling, but really quick, I just want to touch on one thing you said a second ago, Dave. Why is it so important that we demand that FIFA speak out about this and step up? Why is it so important that we don't wait for them to find a spine, but that pressure is put on them to say something?
Well, because we should have a goal that every possible instrument of civil society brings pressure upon Benjamin Netanyahu to stop this awful prosecution of this war in terms of where it is, with over a million people huddled in Rafah right now. This is an emergency situation. And all hands are on deck. So FIFA, to me, is just one of many very influential organizations of civil society. We have to stop thinking of it as a sports organization or just the organization that organizes the World Cup. It's much bigger than that. It's much more powerful than that. Its access to the corridors of power, I think, would shock people, because world leaders know the power of soccer. See, and that's what FIFA likes to say. We're so powerful, we're this instrument of peace. And a lot of people are saying, put up or shut up then. That's what makes it important. It's not just about the influence of soccer and the importance of this soccer body standing up. It's also about the need to pressure all of these instruments in civil society to bring pressure to bear.
Dave, I want to shift gears dramatically and talk about an example of you and why you're the best at what you do with your new piece for The Nation, about how gambling is destroying the sports world. Online gambling has swallowed professional sports. You say it's turning into something that will inevitably cause a great reckoning and could eventually destroy itself. You know, I was trying to think about trying to watch a sports game now, how the experience is always marred by the endless commercials for sports betting that are on TV nonstop. And this is a great piece. I want everyone in the world to read it. Where do we begin in talking about this deal with the devil that our favorite sports teams seem to have made? I mean, I was telling Chris earlier today, when you watch the footage of Lou Gehrig giving his resignation speech, "I'm the luckiest man on the face of the earth," if you look in the background, you will see the words "no gambling" in giant block lettering printed on the wall. And it just seems like we're in this place now where, let me quote you, how are we supposed to trust sports media to examine the corrosive effects of gambling when its economic lifeblood depends on more addicts placing more bets? I mean, this is deeper than sports. This is a human spirit issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, over the course of my life, you know, I've been like, no, we need, you know, less restrictions on things like this. Decriminalization is the watchword that's animated a lot of my life on a host of issues. And yet on this issue, to me, what this is more about is like, it's one thing if, say, you're an alcoholic. It's another thing if, say, someone gets to put a bottle of gin in your freezer, you know, every single day. Yeah. And that's what it means to have these apps on our phones. It's the Wild West. Everybody has, you know, it's one thing to have to travel to the casino and place a bet or go through the hassle.
Right. Yeah.
Those are
no problem with it. Make the trip.
Deterrence. Make the trip. It's another thing when my son comes home from high school and says, Dad, we're raising a generation of amateur bookies here because so many kids at my high school have access to their parents' like FanDuel accounts, and they take bets from kids. And they take a percentage from the kids, and the kids are so into it. They're into it until they owe money, and then things get a little bit hairy. I mean, this is what we're creating. You know, in New Jersey, just to take one example from the 38 states that now allow sports gambling, we're up to 38 out of 50 from 1 out of 50 a decade ago, just to give you an idea of how much has changed. New Jersey is reporting something like a five-fold increase in the number of people who are now calling the statewide gambling addicts hotline in the last couple of years.
Amazing.
A five-fold increase. And the overwhelming majority of those, they have the percentages. People can look them up. I'm sorry, I don't have them off the top of my head. But the overwhelming percentage of the people calling for help are between the ages of 25 and 34. You know, they're grabbing them. And if you think about that, this has been around now for a few years, you're talking about people who probably started in college. It becomes very addictive. It become, you know, you're checking constantly. You're constantly on, you know, we're all addicts to our phones. Now imagine that addiction supersized.
No, I get it.
Sports gambling. So, you know, I wrestle with this so much, but what I've finally come down to is that I love sports. And what this is picking the meat off the bones of the consumer while also creating a snare for generations of players to start betting on the game surreptitiously with the incredible amount of inside information they have, not to mention a lot of athletes also have phone addictions and a lot of downtime and a lot of disposable income. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster. And go ahead.
No, you please, Dave, please.
Just to finish the thought is like, as soon as people start to believe that pro sports has more in common with pro wrestling than an honest outcome, it becomes something ruined. And yeah, it'll limp along and it'll continue to squeeze the lifeblood out of people through these bets and take their percentage, but it's not going to be the kind of mass unifier that sports has the power to be. It's going to become like the smoke-filled back room will become everywhere.
I mean, you said gambling now is the economic lifeblood of sports and much of mainstream sports media. You know, I think when I was growing up, it was just horse racing. I mean, when I realized horse racing, which is very beautiful to watch and very fun and exciting and fascinating, but that it was really had become more about the game than the sport. And now I see this happening all across sports and sports media. Dave, what happens when there are more Pete Rose type stories? What happens when more athletes are found to have compromised their own performance because someone they know made a bet? What happens when people start to think games are rigged? What does that do to a multi-billion dollar sports industry?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, people should start preparing themselves for more Pete Rose stories. They are an absolute, for the reasons we discussed, an inevitability. And what it's going to do is make people cynical about sports. It's going to make parents want to keep their kids shielded from sports, to keep them shielded from their kids becoming that next generation of bookies. It's going to become people watching sports, maybe for the artistry of it, sure, the way people watch pro wrestling for the artistry of the physical movement. But when it comes to thinking that it somehow has an outcome that's on the level, people are going to start doubting that. And they're already doubting it. And when that happens, sports loses the only thing it really has over other forms of entertainment. And that's that the outcome is competitive and not predetermined.
Is this a problem in other countries, Dave? I mean, are sports in Europe or Asia compromised? Are they getting compromised by gambling, or do they have tighter regulations and it's a better balanced system?
No, a total disaster. You're talking about soccer, tennis, fencing. There just was a scandal that just erupted. I mean, they have so decriminalized and deregulated gambling in other parts of the world that match fixing is just a part of the lexicon of sports, the match fixing issue. And we've been largely ignorant of that in the United States, partly because our sports media is in bed with gambling and they don't report on international sports. I mean, that lovely combination means that the average consumer here doesn't know the degree to which gambling has wrecked sports in other countries.
Yeah.
And that is what we're looking at here, with people feeling like the games are in doubt. Already, there's a mini trend in the NBA where if a referee makes a call a player doesn't like, the player gets in their face and makes a big dollar sign with their fingers right in their face.
That's right.
And what are they basically saying? They're saying that you're on the take, that FanDuel is running this operation, and then they get fined sometimes as much as $100,000 for making that little dollar sign. Now, why is the league so scared? I mean, a player can get in a ref's face and tell him that he can go, you know, use his own head as a rectal thermometer, and he probably would get fined $50. But you make that dollar sign with your finger, they're crashing down
on
you because they know how perilous the situation is, and they're trying to nip this in the bud, but they end up being like the people at the dam just trying to stick their finger in every leak, and, you know, it becomes a point where you run out of fingers.
That's it. Dave, well, we have a couple minutes. I have to give you some great praise for your wonderful column about Jonathan Glazer's Oscar speech for one of my favorite movies of the year, Zone of Interest. It's kind of amazing to see how many people have completely twisted his words when he said, "We refute our Jewishness being hijacked for the purpose of drawing moral equivalence between a Nazi regime that sought to exterminate a race of people and an Israeli nation that seeks to avert its own extermination." I thought it was incredibly well thought out and well written. I had no idea so many people would just latch on to the first four words of that sentence and leave the rest out.
Well, when you have as disingenuous a right-wing media machine as we have, you know, nothing would surprise me. And this was almost, but this they entered the realm of the parodical. I mean, it was kind of, if that's a word, is that a word?
Parodical?
It was a parody of itself. In
oh,
other
yes.
Words.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I made it up like Shakespeare. but when it was such a parody, like this idea of just taking, it's like something out of The Simpsons, where you just take the first couple of words, like when Homer was accused of sexual harassment, if people remember that episode, and they take his words and he's like, "I like to touch bottoms," you know,
yes.
And it's like, "How dare you, sir?" You know, it was like that. And hopefully it caused more people to actually read what he had to say, because it was great.
So.
It was the best movie of the year. I totally agree with you about that. Utterly chilling. And like maybe one of the scariest horror films I've ever seen.
I agree. I mean, Holocaust films are their own genre, if that's okay to say. And I'm a fan of good cinema, so I can talk about the good Holocaust films all day, the ones that almost worked but didn't work all day. I've never seen a Holocaust movie like this. I mean, an Auschwitz movie that never shows you inside the gate, only right outside the gate. And I remember seeing his speech and thinking it was so moving, but it was just those first couple words, I refute my Jewishness being yubaba, and they just took refute my Jewishness. And it's still all over social media, people calling him one of the great villains. I mean, Jonathan Poteretz said that, right? That he's one of Judaism's historical villains. The man made one of the best movies ever about the Holocaust. They don't care.
No, they don't care. They have an agenda that they are willing to be disingenuous because they're losing the political argument.
Yes.
And they get vicious. And that's all you're seeing right now. And thank you, Jonathan Glazer, if you're listening to this, for having the courage to stand up to these bullies.
And thank you, Dave Zirin, for covering all these great subjects in your column and for talking about them with us. I love when I can get you. We can run through so many different news items. Mr. Zirin, you are one of the best writers on politics in this country. What is the best way for our listeners to follow you and keep up with your work?
That's incredibly kind. I mean, you search my name in Edge of Sports. You can find me on Threads. You can find me on Instagram. Find me in that other place. Whatever you need to do, reach out. I love talking to folks, especially folks who listen to your show, John, because this is really as good as it gets.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Dave. Have a great, great night, and I'll see you soon. We'll be right back with your calls at 866-997-4748. This is SiriusXM Progress.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And right now it is time once again to welcome back Simon and Julie for everybody's favorite segment. It was a pleasure doing this in person last week. Simon Moya-Smith is an Oglala Lakota and Chicano journalist. He's a contributing writer at NBC News and TheNation.com. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Your Spirit Animal is a Jackass, and he's an adjunct professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Colorado, Denver. Julie Francella is an artist, or an activist, a writer, and a veteran mental health professional with over 28 years of experience working with complex trauma in the clinical field. She's an enrolled member of the Ojibwe Abachawana First Nation Reserve, and she currently works with the First Nations University of Canada and is a professor at Durham College, where she teaches about the profound impacts of colonization on First Nations people. Simon and Julie, welcome back. It's good to have you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Thanks. Simon, we were so delighted to meet your partner, Ray. I hope she wasn't too appalled by anything. The listeners loved her, and thank you very much for bringing her here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And she provided me with a did you know? So at the end of the segment, it'll be one from Ray.
Oh, fantastic. All right,
I'll
make sure we do that then. Nice. We've been talking a lot about disenfranchisement at the ballot box and how it seems like this version of the Democratic Party is starting to realize that they do need the Indigenous voting bloc in this country. Now, Julie, you sent me this story that the San Juan County in New Mexico just settled a lawsuit challenging the county's 2021 redistricting map because it was, of course, deliberately designed to dilute the voting power of Navajo voters.
Yeah.
I mean, what's happened? In my day, this was done just to Black people. Now they're doing it to First Nations people too. What is going on?
Yeah, I mean, in a groundbreaking voting rights win for the Navajo community in New Mexico, San Juan County has settled a lawsuit that challenged its 2021 redistricting map. So this map was said to dilute the voting power of the Navajo voters by unfairly distributing them across districts. And so the victory in New Mexico for the Navajo community, it's crucial because it directly addresses and corrects an issue of voting disenfranchisement, ensuring a fairer representation. And by challenging and changing the redistricting map,
mm-hmm.
it empowers the Navajo voters to have more significant say. Go ahead.
No, please finish. Please go ahead.
Oh. you know, it's not only empowers them to have a more significant say in their governance, but also sets a legal and moral precedent nationwide. And I think that's the key there, setting a precedent. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, it's just comes down to, I mean, something we've talked about a lot of times, like allowing the people, the Navajo people, to have some kind of agency for the infrastructure on their own land. I mean, Simon, this just seems like a basic justice question, but it took the ACLU and all these other firms getting involved to bring this lawsuit on behalf of the Navajo Nation.
Well, and a lot of this voter suppression happens in places like New Mexico. New Mexico has a large population of indigenous people. Of course, you know, just to give everybody a little history 101, you know, westward expansion. That's why there's so many reservations out here versus in the East Coast. So you're going to find voter suppression attempts by the GOP in South Dakota, North Dakota, New Mexico, even up there in Anchorage, where there's a larger population of indigenous people. They know we can shift the vote, we can swing a vote. And so that attempt to suppress indigenous people at the ballot box is ongoing, and it happens in many different states out here in the West.
I mean, Julie, it seems like this is really a story about not giving up. I mean, this is all due to the Navajo Nation and their allies standing up against this and not just despairing and saying, okay, well, it's not going to get better. I mean, they kept on fighting and kept on fighting.
You know, and that's, I think, what our nations are built on. You know, as we've said before in the past, United States is built on the hope that Native Americans won't be here anymore. And so, you know, that idea of not giving up. And, you know, I think Native Americans are, you know, just based on their history and based on, you know, that the way that they are in the world, they're very resilient, and not giving up is something that I think is embedded in our blood. So,
yeah, absolutely.
That's why we're still here.
That's I was going to say, one of the phrases you guys have taught me that we almost called this segment was "We're still here," and and it's interesting as well, because right over next door in Texas, they're trying to get the Texas State Board of Education to approve an American Indian Native Studies elective for Texas high schoolers. You wouldn't think this would be too controversial, especially in Texas. But it seems like even that's an uphill battle.
Well, it always is, especially when it comes to Native content, right? That's why you see that there's like, when I was there in New York, I saw a big old billboard and it said, they're teaching our children to hate America. And it's like, we're trying to show you what actually happened, history without the bullshit and the lies. And so and especially what's really shitty is to learn about indigenous people, you have to go to college often. You can't learn about us in high school. And so when they leave high school, they start to understand that, oh my God, I've been indoctrinated not even to see indigenous people or ask any questions about indigenous people or question Thanksgiving or Columbus, et cetera, or sports mascots. But in Texas, hopefully they will allow these students to study indigenous people in high school and not just in college.
Yeah. I'm curious, what was your experience, both of you growing up, in your education systems with learning about your own heritage and culture? I mean, Julie, what were you taught? Not at home, but taught by the school system?
Yeah. Again, it was very, pardon the term, but very whitewashed. You know, you go to the museums in Regina, Saskatchewan, actually it's still there. One of them says, you know, the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, you know, they partnered with the Indigenous people, but the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, were actually hired and created to police the Native Americans or the Indigenous people in Canada. And so growing
really?
Up, you know, the history wasn't taught. You know, the history of the residential schools wasn't taught. As I was saying before, I think 42% of Canadians don't know that the residential school system happened in Canada. They don't know the true history. And it's not until you go to university and you can take a class on, you know, Indigenous history as an elective, but it is not, it's not a part of the curriculum. That's changing now. And now it's starting to become part of, you know, the mainstream curriculum in schools. But when I was growing up, it wasn't at all. And again, people didn't even realize that Native Americans and Indigenous people still existed. You know, they thought
That's
that
right.
we went out with the buffalo. So, yeah.
Simon, what was your experience like? You've talked a bit about it, but you know, what did you obviously went in there knowing who you were. What did the schools tell you?
It was a lot of the same bullshit. I used to get sent home on Columbus Day, in the LA Unified School District because I wouldn't participate in it. You know, I guess I was disrupting. So Columbus Day actually was a day that my mom and I would go, and she would take me to lunch because I was too disruptive as a kid. And then when I went to middle
I love
school,
you
the
so
mascot
much.
was an Indian. Yeah, so she would take me to lunch, and it was like a perfect day. She was really happy because I would poo-poo the Nina Pinta and Santa Maria cupcakes, etc. And then when I went to middle school, the mascot was an Indian. And so you guys can look this up. This is a true thing. It was Griffiths Middle School, 1995. And the vice principal would start the morning announcements with "Good morning, Injuns and Injunettes," and he did not know this was a slur until the American Indian Movement in Southern California stepped up and said, "Hey, you've got two indigenous kids here, and you're also using a racial slur about indigenous people." And this was, you know, he was a PhD, and he just shrugged, "I don't know." So I honestly think that I was created by the education system. And even when I went to college, I studied English because our elders said it's the language of the liars and you need to know the languages they use to lie. And so that we're talking about treaties and promises, false promises, broken promises. So I really feel I was molded by the education system.
I'll see. It sounds like you were the one giving them the education, Simon.
Oh yeah, and even in college, when I was at Columbia, I took a class and I was the only indigenous person in there. Everyone in there was African American, and I was like, you know, fuck Abraham Lincoln, and they were like, whoa, how do you say that? And I was like, well, you guys don't know about the Dakota 38, and so I had to teach them why indigenous people hate Abraham Lincoln, how he's just as bad as many. Like we'll put up pictures of Columbus, Jackson, you know, Andrew Jackson, and then of course Abraham Lincoln, and we're like, fuck those guys.
Yeah, right. Wow. So what do you think about this happening in Texas? I mean, to me, it seems incredibly promising and encouraging and moving, especially because I'm sure it's not just indigenous kids fighting for this. This is civil rights groups. This is white students as well who want to have this kind of, I mean, education. I just imagine the ripple effects if Texas has this for high school, even as an elective. I mean, what could it mean around the whole country? Am I being falsely optimistic here?
I don't think you're being falsely optimistic, but again, it depends on what they're going to teach, who's going to do the teaching. It's great that they're going to have indigenous studies, but I've heard a lot of non-natives who teach indigenous studies use the wrong language, and the lessons are just very skewed. So I would want to look at the curriculum before I get excited that they're going to even entertain the idea of having indigenous studies.
Very good point. Very good
I
point.
think this course in particular is designed with input from dozens of Native nations. And so, I mean, I think they're off to a good start. I think that's a really good start.
Let me go to the phones, if I may, because Russ is on the line from Idaho. Russ on line six, welcome. Thank you so much for waiting on hold. You're on SiriusXM with Simon and Julie. Hello.
Hey, good to hear you guys. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, Russ. Hi,
Oh,
Russ.
great. Hey, how's everyone doing? Hey,
Good.
So, well, John, a couple things. So first of all, like this show is it gets me thinking so much. Like even this conversation right now, I'm just thinking about how I grew up. I grew up on Long Island, and
Where on
there
Long
was a
Island?
lot of
Where on Long
on
Island?
Long Island. Oh, what
Where?
part? I grew up on the North
Yeah.
Shore, Fort Salonga. So
Okay, I'm from
in
Stonybrook,
between.
not too far. Yeah.
Yeah, I grad I Kings Park High School is where I went to, but
Oh, right
so
on.
I grew up like Missisquoi River, Ronkonkoma, like all the you know, there were so many native names that were just kind of there, and you know,
Yeah.
we were aware to a degree of native culture, but it was really like Julie said before, like it's like it was all so whitewashed.
Yeah.
And we did, and actually, Simon, something you just said too. So we learned native culture stuff when we were young, like in elementary school, and again, really whitewashed. It was, you know, sort of how native folks lived, housing, how they ate, how they interacted. Allegedly with white folks. But like it was in elementary school and there was nothing past that. So you guys just got me thinking about that. This isn't even why I
Yeah.
called. I called for an
That's
entirely
okay.
different reason. But
What did you call
in
for?
any case, so I called about, again last week, the football stuff came up and it got me thinking. So I went to college in Buffalo, which I believe. Buffalo is probably a ignorant misnomer, I'm guessing. I did a little bit of research. So bison, were wiped out by white people in the late 1700s. I'm guessing buffalo probably got their name from bison. I don't know.
Yeah, but there were buffalo up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. So the Buffalo Bills, I was wondering since last week, like if that's like another NFL name that's either like there's cultural appropriation there or Buffalo Bill Cody, who I don't think had anything to do with Western New York.
Like, no, he was like the P.T. Barnum of Manifest
that's
Destiny.
That's exactly what I was going to say, mm-hmm. John. So P.T. Barnum, I had a few. There's a few different questions in here. You know, one, Buffalo Bills, is the name like cultural appropriation? Is it, racist proximity to Buffalo Bill Cody, or is it complete nonsense? But then I also my second part of this question is Buffalo Bill Cody. So here's a guy who participated in wars against Native Americans and then, quote unquote, evolved to this P.T. Barnum thing where it seems like it was exploitative. But again, allegedly, he was paying Native Americans the same way as he was paying white folks. Like, what do you guys think about that whole package?
I love the question. Well, Simon, Julie, I've never thought about this one before.
Yeah, the Buffalo Bills actually is named after Buffalo Bill Cody. And in the 1960s, it was established that team is a charter member of the Football League. But the decision to name the team the Bills was a result of a naming contest. And so that is where the name comes from, Buffalo Bills. Mm. And, it's for me, I'm not really a fan of, any of that kind of naming, just because, it's kind of, he was a hunter of buffalo. And if you know anything about the history of the buffalo, it was the food source for the Native Americans and the indigenous people on Turtle Island. And that was one of the ways that they decimated the Native or indigenous populations here, was to get rid of the buffalo. And that wasn't by accident. It was by design. And so, you can argue that it's harmless. Some people might say that. But again, you have to look at who the name represents. And Buffalo Bill Cody was, known as a buffalo hunter. So,
yeah. And that was, the buffalo were deliberately hunted to starve the Indians. That was it. Yeah. That
kill
was
the buffalo.
By design.
Yeah. Right. And kill the buffalo, kill the people. That was exactly what they thought.
I'm finding all new stuff to have liberal outrage over. Simon, what do you think?
Well, and again, you know what always drove me fucking crazy, and it still does it to this day, is like you'd have people like Buffalo Bill, like they hated our indigenous names, and so they were like, you're gonna get a Christian name, and then they turn around and give themselves fucking Indian names even today. So first they ban our names, and then they give us these bland Christian names that didn't tell you shit. That's again, and I've mentioned this to you guys before, that your name could change up to 3 times in your life based on your behavior. If you did something really bad, that would be your name. And so it was a way to keep ourselves in check. So if the idea that they would ban our names and then give us something like John Smith, we're like, what the fuck does that even mean? That doesn't tell me anything about this person's character. But then they turn around, and even today here in Santa Fe, somebody's like, well, my Indian name is like, no, that's not how that works. First, you force your Christian names on us that don't tell us shit. And now you give yourself an Indian name to be cool.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always weird. But then also going back to Buffalo Bill and the parading of indigenous people, I think you guys remember this. I don't know if I mentioned this on the show. My great grandfather is buried in Dresden, Germany. A full-blooded Oglala Lakota is buried in Dresden, Germany, because the Europeans came over and bought Indians to take back to Europe to parade around in what were called human zoos. Well, when it was time for my grandfather to come back, he was like, the white people here treat me better than the white people at home. Just bury me here. So Ray and I are going to go visit his grave this July for like the 110th anniversary of his passing.
Wow.
Jeez. All right. Can I end this on a positive?
Aren't you glad you asked, Russ? That was great. I just learned so much. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. A few weeks ago, I don't know if you guys were aware of this or if you caught it, but the boys basketball state championships here in Idaho. It was Lapaw and Lakeside, and back to back, those two schools met, both native schools, and last year Lakeside won and this year Lapaw won. So that was pretty cool. It's not something you see very often.
No. Nice. And then you'll hear, especially on reservations, for native kids, basketball is life. And it saves a lot of those kids from, life. You know, yeah, basketball is life. You can look that up. There's so many campaigns to help kids who are on reservations who maybe suffer from, you know, somebody in the house is suffering from an addiction. But through basketball, these kids are growing and they even will go to college, go back to the reservation. But for Indigenous people, the sport is typically basketball, if not lacrosse. Yeah.
Or in Canada, hockey. And if you watched Indian Horse, which I know you mentioned last time you called Russ, you watched Indian Horse and you saw that hockey initially was saving this young boy's life in the residential schools. So
nice. A memory on you,
well,
Julie.
Love what you guys do. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Guys, I really hate to bring up this next story, but I know you wanted to talk about it, Julie. I just hate talking about this guy, Nicholas Sandman, who you all might remember. When he was 16 years old, he was on a bus with a bunch of other white Christian kids, and they went to Washington, D.C. to try to demonstrate to take rights away from women, to take abortion rights away from women, because he's so Christian, even though abortion's not banned by the Bible. You remember the story. While they were hanging out, these students at Covington Catholic from Northern Kentucky, there was an elder, a First Nations rights activist, Nathan Phillips, at the Lincoln Memorial. And we've all seen the footage of this young, privileged, spoiled punk getting in this old man's face, nose to nose, just to smile and mock him, just to intimidate, just to be a smug little petulant brat. So, of course, you know, he was reported for being what he was, and this guy went and filed lawsuits against the New York Times and ABC and CBS and Rolling Stone, looking for like over $1 billion because he said he had been so defamed. Julie, I understand that his little case is saying that he had been canceled, this little Trump-supporting, fake Christian, Indian-mocking brat. It finally went to the Supreme Court this week, didn't it?
Yeah, it sure did.
What happened?
It's so funny. I mean, again, like, it's that entitlement, you know. He gets in the face of this, you know, Indigenous elder. He's wearing his MAGA hat, Make America Great Again.
Yeah.
And he's complaining that he got a bad rap, and he literally tried to sue, saying, you know, for $1.25 billion.
This
dollars.
Little punk who'd been making fun of this old Indian man, like just getting in his face to intimidate him because he knew he could. I'm sorry, I still hate this brat. Go on.
Yeah, but he's saying that, you know, oh, well, I got canceled, you know, and so I'm going to sue all of these, you know, news outlets or whatever. And this is the part that I love. The Supreme Court recently declined to even hear the case. So they declined to even hear him speak, or which I think is a perfect. He got canceled by the judge, which is even funnier.
By this Trump Supreme Court as well, this little MAGA brat. And again, I don't want to be too mean, but I mean, Simon, I just never had any patience for this guy. He just worked the system, made himself the victim, this privileged little white kid who was just, I mean, anyone can watch the video and you'll just see he's just mocking the old man. And of course, liberals being what liberals are, we all freaked out and said, look at this little monster. And then he tried to sue the whole world for defaming him. I mean, the privilege never ends. I've been dying to get your thoughts on this, Simon.
Yeah, well, I was there.
A
lot of us were there for the Indigenous Peoples March, right?
Yeah.
And so Nathan stuck around, and nobody knows why. We were asking what the hell, because we had all left the march at Lincoln Center to go and have a bite to eat at DuPont Circle. And then news starts to break that there's this little shit in the face of Nathan Phillips, who's this very gentle elder that he was up at Standing Rock. He's a very significant elder in our community, especially when it comes to activism. But it's really important for people to know that Nathan wasn't there by himself, in the sense that he's just stuck around. And so when we were leaving, of course, we were hearing these kids, all these little Catholic kids, doing war whoops and laughing hysterically because we had Indigenous people there who were, they had the drum, they were in regalia or whatever. But if memory serves, somebody said that Nathan just wanted to go and share a culture with the kids that were there, and then they just started laughing at him. And
Trump defended this kid, right-wing media defended this kid. I'm sorry, go on.
No, yeah, I think it's just that context that people need to understand, that Nathan didn't just like walk into a group of privileged Christian white kids. He was there because we had marched earlier that day, and he stuck around. We had gone to get food, but the sadness about that is that these kids were laughing in the face of an elder. Now flip it around. Imagine if it was a bunch of Indian kids laughing in the face of a white person, of a white Christian who maybe wanted to share a little of, I don't know, their culture. But when it came to this narrative, this kid was playing the victim. And that's the problem, is that there's this idea of us as indigenous people being politically correct and that we're always the victim. Bullshit. This is a perfect example of white privilege.
Amen. Yeah. I mean, and again, this kid, his lawyer said, oh, he was transformed from a quiet, anonymous teenager into a national pariah, one whose embarrassed smile in response to Philip's aggression became a target aggression for anger and hatred. I mean, people need to watch the video to see how petulant this kid was. So he filed these lawsuits. Federal judge in Kentucky laughed him out of court 2 years ago. And then there was the other appeals court that laughed him out. And now The Supreme Court, Donald Trump's own Supreme Court, has declined to hear his case. I mean, I guess we're done with This guy until he gets his job on Newsmax, right, Julie? Like that, until he gets his inevitable Fox News internship.
Yeah, he'll be Jesse Waters' co-host, I'm sure.
Oh.
You had to say
it's
that
just
name.
Like, yeah. Ooh, it's just like Kyle Rittenhouse. I owe you an apology. One last thing I want to talk to you about, and then I want to do some Did You Knows while we have the time, but it is 1 year since Pope Francis disavowed the doctrine of discovery. Now, this is the sort of thing that I think needs to be taught in school, because I never learned what the doctrine of discovery was until I grew up and began researching the history of religion. But this is a set of ideas that the Spanish and Portuguese used more or less pre-manifest destiny to justify seizing land they had discovered. It's colonizer language. You are allowed to take it because you discovered it. Oh, sorry, people already living here. It's 1 year to the date. And so a lot of the people I follow are celebrating this anniversary. But obviously the culture at large doesn't know much about it and doesn't know much about the doctrine of discovery. Simon, this is something you've known about for a long time. I mean, I guess First Nations kids are taught about this the way white kids should be.
Yeah, we studied it not only in college, but we talked about it in the house. So it's the basis for Indian law, for federal Indian law. So when people go like, okay, so what is Native American law? And, you know, well, it's based on a papal bull by a pope from like the 1400s called the Inter Caetera, where he said, look, there are savages and there's land. Convert the savages. And if you can't convert them, take the land. Well, even if they could convert an indigenous person, they still took the land. And so the idea, and we have to remember on this continent, again, what we call Turtle Island, billions with a B, billions of acres have been stolen from indigenous people because of these papal bulls, and especially the doctrine of discovery, the idea that they are white, they are Christian, and they can take whatever the fuck they want, and they did. And then again, please everybody Google this, but you look up the picture of Manifest Destiny, and it is this white woman clutching a Bible and indigenous people running away because they genuinely believed that Christ gave them and their lily white asses the right to take land away from indigenous people. And that's the basis of doctrine of discovery. We can take it. You're savages. You're not Christians. So it's ours.
Boom.
Yeah. But, you know, I want to say this is the 1 year anniversary, but indigenous Catholics have been fighting this battle long before, you know, the hashtags were a thing, demanding that the church not just acknowledge its past sins, but truly integrate indigenous traditions and languages into its very fabric. And this isn't just about, you know, correcting the history, but it really is about rewriting the present. And for Indigenous Catholics, and there are many Indigenous Catholics, my mother was an Indigenous Catholic, you know, it's a quest, not just for the respect, but for a church that mirrors the diverse faces of its followers, right? Because there are a lot of Indigenous Catholics. And so the Pope's move, it's a start, you know, that he denounced this. But as indigenous communities know all too well, the road from acknowledgement to action is a long one. So that's, I think, where we're kind of holding our breath and hoping for, you know, more action and not just acknowledgements like that.
Well, and then also, guys, with the doctrine of discovery, really quickly, Yeah. But we were considered wards of the state. So that meant, so white people believed that Native Americans were no better than children, and that children cannot own land. So that was also a part of the Doctrine of Discovery. They thought we were simpletons. They didn't think that we had the capacity to think complexly. And so they said, okay, these Indians cannot even own land. We're just going to own it for them. We'll be mommy and daddy.
Boom.
Yeah.
Boom. Guys, I want to get to a did you know. Can you wait after the break, and can I keep you a little longer?
Let's do it.
We'll be right back in just a second with your calls and Simon and Julie. This is SiriusXM Progress. Don't go away.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back. 866-997-GRIT is our number. Did we lose Pastor John? We lost Pastor John. So sorry, sir. We're going to take your call. In the meantime, Simon and Julie, it's been a week. I need some did you knows. What do you got, Simon?
Well, and I think we mentioned this in studio, and this comes from Ray, and we were off the air. We were doing a break. But remember we told you how we send ghosts back?
Yes.
Right. So up there in Anchorage, specifically with Ray's people, a Yupik and a Nupak, if, say, a white person goes to an indigenous grave and steals, say, like a tea kettle, and they use it in, you know, in the evening, well, the ghost will typically appear until you take that tea kettle back to their grave. Well, if you're trying to send a ghost back, what you have to do is put the weight of your hand on the top of the ghost's head. You can't push them into the soil. You have to let the weight of your hand push them back into the soil, and then usually we, you know, tell the white people to put the tea kettle back.
I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Julie, was this the same for you? Did you learn this growing up?
A little different, yeah. But, I mean, if we found things, that's why I like the ending of True Detective, which I won't talk about on the air until, you know, I know lots of people have watched it, but we should talk about that. Because I have an idea of what happened in the end, and people are like, "Really? I didn't even think about that." I'm like, "That's very traditionally indigenous." Yes.
Okay. Cool. Well, what is your did you know, Julie?
Did you know that 70% of new drugs introduced in the United States in the past 25 years have been derived from traditionally used natural products by indigenous peoples? 70%.
Wow.
That's
I have
lot.
No idea. Can you give an example?
Yeah. The willow bark is willow bark, which basically is aspirin.
Oh, right
I don't
on.
Know if you know that.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Wow. Let me go to the phones. Brian's on the line from South Dakota. Brian, welcome. You're on SiriusXM with Simon and Julie. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to do, did you know?
Please.
About Cahokia. In 1290... Cahokia was an indigenous city that eclipsed the population of London and several other major cities in Europe. And this was about 13 to 14,000 people living at Cahokia, which is currently near Collinsville, Illinois. And it was an incredibly complex and advanced city with an incredibly complex religious and political classes, and the engineering feats that Cahokia are absolutely incredible. Thank you.
How did you learn about it? Since I'm guessing your public school didn't teach you.
I actually went there after I read about it, and I went there. I said some prayers because I am Dakota and Anishinaabe, and
Anishinaabe.
It was there's a real sense of an ancient world there, and it's a very sacred place. They had a solar calendar that accurately predicted the solstice.
That's right.
And every season at this solar calendar, it's an incredible place, and everybody should go.
Right on.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Julie.
I was going to say, you actually took my did you know. That was one of my did you knows.
Was it?
Well, it's called the Native Stonehenge.
Yeah, and we have to remember there was upward of 100,000 indigenous people in one given area at the time of invasion, remember, not colonization. And then also the language that we use when we're talking about Europe, that's the new world. For us, this is the old world.
That's
and
right.
So they talk about all the time is like, well, in the new world. No, the new world is if when I go to Germany to go see the grave of my great grandfather in Dresden, I'll be like, oh, look around. I'm looking at the new world because it's about perspective.
It's all subjective. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
Simon, what is the best way for our listeners to follow you and keep up with all your work?
On Instagram at Simon Said Take a Pic, or on Twitter or X at Simon Moya Smith.
And Julie, do you want to fill in a bit more on the last Did You Know?
Oh, well, he's right. And remarkably, it was precisely aligned to capture the rising sun during solstices and equinoxes, serving as a grand calendar for the Mississippian culture, which Mississippi, over 1,000 years ago, which is now, as you said, Illinois. So that's incredible.
It's amazing. And Julie, what is the best way for our listeners to follow you and keep up with all your many doings?
You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Julie Francella, and I have a website, juliefrancella.com.
Guys, I want to thank you both so much. I love this segment and look forward to it every week, and so do our listeners. Really appreciate all that you do. We got to go. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Thea. I'm John Fugelsang. Keep it tuned to SiriusXM Progress. Peace.